The Airplane Geeks podcast is proudly sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight.
Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 212 of the show, where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flightbot, and I'm joined by two capable co-hosts. First is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Max, what happened to your voice? I mean, you sound so robotic.
I'll hold your questions until later. Our other co-host is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
I can't do it. It's MaxBot. Well, I just goes to show, folks. Earlier in the week, I woke up to like 20 emails from this guy by the name of Max Flight. So I came to the conclusion that Max Flight actually was a spammer and a bot. And well, evidently, this is the truth. We have MaxBot tonight.
Thank you. Now, moving on. And now, to introduce our guest for the episode is the real Max Flight, who does exist.
All right. Well, I guess enough of that. Our guest this episode comes from UPS. That's Mike Manjo. He is the public relations manager for UPS Airlines. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
I am Mike Manjo, but you could change the spelling and get Mike Manjbot very easily.
Yeah, for you new listeners, this is not the way we normally open the show, but we thought we'd do something a little different this time. Mike, I really want to thank you for coming on the show. UPS is kind of interesting. People might think of UPS in a lot of different ways, but UPS actually has quite an airline behind it, as well as the trucks and other things that people see. I understand that UPS serves over 700 different airports and has up to or around 1,800 flights a day. That's quite a lot.
That's correct. We reach 700 different gateways in over 220 countries and territories around the world. About 1,800 flights at any given time somewhere in the world. 365 days a year, a UPS jet is in the air.
Wow, that's just amazing. Well, we're going to talk about that and talk about sort of air freight and express delivery from the aviation perspective. And I think that'll be kind of interesting. It's an area that we haven't really talked about in the past. So we're looking forward to our conversation with you, Mike. Before we do that, we've got a little bit of aviation news from the past week. And let's see, we also have David, your This Week in Aviation History segment. Have we got an aircraft of the week, David?
The Mitsubishi T4, a two-seat trainer from Japan.
Very good. And we also have the Australia Desk report from Steve and Grant of the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast. And as always, or almost always, our European contributor, Peter Johnson, brings us some aviation news from that region. This time he talks with Rohit Rao again about aviation in India, and that's in his Across the Pond segment. And we'll close up with a little bit of listener mail, maybe a couple of Grill the Geeks questions. First, though, let's get started with the aviation news. Are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Yep.
Our first story comes from the Star Telegram. This is Strike Talk from American Pilots Hits the Bottom Line. There's a quote in here. The board of directors of the Allied Pilots Association ordered its officers to, quote, make the necessary preparations to conduct a strike vote of the membership, unquote, if the airline gets approval from a federal bankruptcy judge and implements new contract terms. kind of an interesting development. Rob, were you expecting this to happen?
I don't know what's more interesting to me about this story, the story itself, or the fact that Mike Norman from the Star Telegram was so completely amazed that the pilots at American are talking about a strike. I mean, I guess for a guy that seems to be as old as he is in his picture, which is almost my age, this is what I would expect. The pilots have no other choice at this point that I can see, because what the company has already told them is that, look, we're going back to the federal judge, and either you agree, and if you don't, well, then we're going to get them to throw the contract out, and it's been nice working with you guys at whatever we decide we're going to pay you. So why not talk strike? I mean, what's the point? I mean, why not?
So are you thinking that they don't have anything to lose, really?
I don't think they do. I mean, I've talked to quite a few American pilots, and they're fed up, and I think that I think it's happened at a lot of the passenger carriers, because they feel like they've made so many concessions, some even before 9/11, but certainly in the last decade. And now the one thing he does mention in his story, I think that's absolutely true, is the pilots and a lot of the other employees are saying, look, we didn't get us here. And for goodness sake, why should we take even more cuts on top of the cuts we took the last time when management came to us and said, we really, really, really need your help to keep the company afloat. And don't worry, we'll take care of you when times are good. And it sort of doesn't ever seem to come back to them. And I think they're just, you know, kind of irritated.
Now, in this story, the author, he mentions that even the suggestion of a strike can cause financial harm, because you know, customers are likely to stay away.
And this is where the response is, that's the point.
That's what they're, well, I don't know.
Well, sure. I mean, they're trying to use what leverage they do have with the company. And, of course, now, if they do impose the contract, or I mean, what they'll do is they'll most likely impose the terms that are the most favorable to American that they offered them at some point in the negotiations. And if the pilots choose not to take it, that's when it's going to get really interesting.
Do you think because of the history, if this was another airline, a different airline, that maybe the behavior would be different? I mean, do you think this is really kind of specific to American Airlines?
Well, Americans had some pretty bad labor relations for the last 25 years. But then if you look at United, United's had the same thing. Continental has been fairly stable up until the time they were purchased by United. But, I mean, if you go back in history, 30 years ago when Lorenzo was running Continental, it was insanity. It was chaos. A couple of bankruptcies. They hired the replacement pilots under the strike. Oh, it was insane. but the industry's been fairly stable from labor issues, except at American. I mean, there was, as Norman mentions, there was that strike 90, I can't remember now, 98, 99, somewhere, where bunch of the pilots called in sick, and they took the union to task for violating a federal court order and charged them a whole, I don't know, $30 or $40 million in penalties. And so in the last decade or two, nobody has looked very kindly on labor strikes in the airline industry. So I wouldn't expect that they're going to get a lot of support outside of American for this. So we'll see what happens, though.
Yeah. Well, presumably this won't go on as long as David's tanker story did the other year, but I think this is going to have a long and kind of interesting history as it unfolds.
Oh, I think it will. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on. Next item on a sad note, and I'm sure everybody has heard this and is aware by now, but we lost Neil Armstrong. The astronaut, the pilot, the test pilot, had quite an extremely interesting career. There is a video series on the Bottom Line from CPA Australia, of all places. It's a video interview series, a multi-part series with Neil Armstrong. I'm not sure when this was recorded, but it's fairly interesting. We'll put the link to that in the show notes. And if you'd like to watch Neil talk about some of his experiences and so forth, this is a great place to do it, because I guess, David, he wasn't really prone to giving a lot of interviews and appearing in public.
He actually was an extremely quiet, reserved man. I think personally he looked at from my opinion of it, is he looked at what he did was just a job, a day, you know, how extraordinary it was. But for him, it was just another task as a engineer and as a test pilot. Was always very quiet when he was teaching. He was not the outspoken one of the crew. Buzz was the outspoken one. Neil was just the quiet, reserved.
Right.
John Glenn was always out there. He just wanted to go back to his daily life after he walked on the moon, which is kind of an extraordinary thought. Mm. And he thought he did his job, he did it well, and now he could carry on with the rest of his life. And while the rest of the world sort of looked at him in complete awe.
Well, I have a little clip from this video interview from CPA Australia. This is Neil talking a little bit about being a test pilot.
So, Neil, your test pilot career was, you know, as everything else in your career, a distinguished one. But tell me what a test pilot feels and what it does feel like to get in those jets, as you did so often, the exhilaration, the moment, the responsibility.
The test pilot is solving problems. He's looking for inadequacies or shortcomings or barriers to substantial safety and increasing performance in flight. And his job is to identify those problems and assist in finding a solution. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem-solving job. And you're always working with the unknowns. And I found that a fascinating part of my career path. I really enjoyed the opportunity to contribute in some way to the solution of problems.
And David, he really did fly a wide variety of airplanes in his career.
Oh, absolutely. He was as good a test pilot as, say, someone like Chuck Yeager, except Yeager was a pilot's pilot. Armstrong was an engineer. I mean, he was an engineer first, a pilot second. So if you listen to that clip, that's very telling that he thought about it as a problem-solving thing. He was a mental pilot, whereas maybe you want to think of Yeager as a stick-and-rudder pilot. But, I mean, besides being shot down in an F-9, F-2 Panther in Korea, he flew things from the F-100 Super Sabre to a B-29 that dropped the DD-5882, which was the Douglas Skyrocket test aircraft, and earned his astronaut wings before he flew in space by flying the X-15 to earn his wings. So when he went into the Gemini program, he was already a civilian test pilot and technically an astronaut because of the altitude he flew in the X-15 program, which he only had 7 flights in.
I understand he reached an altitude in that in the X-15 of a little over 207,000 feet, which is just phenomenal, and a speed of just under 4,000 miles an hour. That's pretty zippy.
Yeah, he has the record for the longest distance flight in the X-15, as well as... So he went out farther over the Pacific than anybody was supposed to. There's a lot of stories out there about some of his exploits as a test pilot, where did things like the landing gear didn't come down and wrecked the bottom of an airplane. And he had an interesting reputation as a test pilot. But all of that is neither here nor there when you're the first man to walk on another astronomical item like the moon.
Yeah, absolutely. Rob, do you remember watching that moon landing? You remember Neil Armstrong taking that step?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Actually, I do. I was a I was a sergeant in the United States Air Force at that point in 69. And I remember all, because I was actually in the United Kingdom at the time, and we all stayed up. Oh, God, the whole barracks was alive. It must have been 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I think, London time, when that happened. And there was nobody sleeping in that building because we were all watching this. Sure. And we just thought that was the coolest thing in the whole world. And I think if there's anything I remember more today, it's the fact that that is still a big deal to me to have watched that, and how little people today seem to care about. Even look at the I'm shot. What's the name of the Mars lander that just went in?
Curiosity.
I was going to say adventurous, but no, that was when Robbie was here a couple of weeks ago. But Curiosity, what a marvelous technological development that was. Even though it was not manned, and that has not caused 1/100th of the publicity that the moon landing did. There's still going to be nothing like that, I don't think.
Hmm. Mike, how about you? I don't know. I'm not sure how old you are, but were you around when Neil Armstrong stepped out onto the moon?
I was very young when it happened, but I do remember it. I have, you know, kind of grainy memories of the video on TV.
Right.
It left an indelible impression on the world. Not just the aviation community or the aerospace community. It was an amazing, amazing thing. And you talk about his humility and the fact that it was just kind of something he did. You know, so many people of that generation, and that's that whole Greatest Generation group, did these amazing things and then just went back to work. My father's of that age, and some of our relatives who went off and fought World War II or did these other things, and it's just what they did. It's not a big deal to those guys, and it's a lesson in humility that probably a lot of people would be well served to heed today.
Yeah, Mike, I think that's an excellent point. It's a good observation too, and an excellent point. David, what did all that mean to you? You weren't able to watch that live as it happened, I assume.
No, but it has a dramatic effect on my life. I arrived on this planet 9 months to the day, almost.
David, you have to tell us this story. You know you're not going to get away without that.
The guys already know this story, but for all intents and purposes, I'm a child of the lunar landing. My parents and my mother and my father watched the show in their excitement, had a couple too many cocktails, to put it succinctly, and eventually 9 months later, I arrived. So there are very few people who know the day that they arrived on the planet. I arrived on the planet the same day Neil Armstrong arrived on the moon.
Wow.
So it's been always, since the day I found out from when my mother told me, I've always had a affinity. It does explain why I'm so enamored with aircraft and space. I'm a product of it.
Literally. Okay, very good. Yeah, and as for myself, I remember the Mercury launches. I remember Gemini and all the Apollo. I'm not as old as Rob, but as a young child, I was fascinated by that stuff, and that's what really got me interested. I mean, my interest in aviation, is kind of a derivative of my original interest in space, and they're intertwined to a certain extent. But I think my greatest regret in life, that I will publicly admit, is I regret that I never had an opportunity or made the opportunity to go down to Florida and watch a Saturn V launch. I really wish I'd been able to see one of those. Okay, speaking of large, next item comes from the Philadelphia, who does this come from? Philadelphia CBS affiliate, I guess. Southwest, American Airlines under fire for dress code enforcement. And we've had some more incidents. A Southwest Airlines passenger was refused boarding because apparently somebody thought that she showed too much cleavage. That was my large transition. And an American Airlines passenger encountered problems for wearing a T-shirt with a curse word on it that was seen by the airline as inappropriate. And, you know, airlines don't have, I guess, for the most part, published dress codes. And there's certainly no regulatory dress code retirement. It's up to the airlines. Some people think this is a great idea, and other people are kind of upset with this. I don't know. Where do you guys fall in that spectrum?
It's good luck.
It's their airline. They can do what they want.
Yeah, I've seen a quote from somebody that says, well, you know, what about freedom of speech? And I guess the point is that, well, yeah, there's freedom of speech in public areas in certain places. But when you're in a business, when you're in a restaurant, when you're in a store someplace, you just don't have free rein to do whatever you feel like. The owners have the ability to, you know, ask you to leave or cover up or something if they think it's inappropriate.
No shirt, no shoes, no service.
Well, there you go. There's a great example.
That's right. And that's been around for, I don't know how long, but, and the only reason that ever existed or came to exist was because someone pushed the limit. They pushed the envelope. And this is not the first time that the Southwest Airlines brand has been linked to flight attendants saying, hey, no, sorry, not happening. And I agree. I think that a company has the right, I don't care if you paid for your seat or not, that if you are making everybody else uncomfortable for whatever reason, they have the right to say, mm-mm, not on my airplane. And then if, you know, customer service wants to give those people their money back or argue about it, that's another story. But I think the cabin crew, the pilots, or the flight attendants have the right to say this is not happening.
And Southwest has got a family image. They want to have a family wholesome, they sort of have a wholesome family non-toxic image that they want to get, and they don't want to upset their travelers. So I think they have a right. If it's affecting their brand, which in this case, how, you don't know, but you have an image to uphold, and if you're somebody comes on and, let's face it, we need a lot of common sense. I mean, I was down the Jersey Shore this weekend, and no, not the Snooki Jersey Shore, the South Jersey Shore, and there are rows and rows of T-shirt stands where the T-shirts are of questionable. It's like, okay, who really wears that? And they've tried very hard to change the tone, and it's sort of like, there's a huge fight down the shore because, you know, the T-shirt guys say, well, if the kids want to buy them, who are we to stop them? And the rest of the town is saying, well, do you really think they're appropriate? They probably could, you could probably tone it down a couple of notches and still sell T-shirts. So, but in this case, Southwest is a brand and they're trying to uphold it.
So, David, did you buy a T-shirt?
No, I have enough of them.
Okay.
However,
dun, 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 dun.
I have been on record as telling the people at Southwest, whom I must admit, in full disclosure, I like because I'm a Rapid Rewards member, and they are very nice to me. But then in all fairness, they're very nice to everybody. I did tell them that if they ever got themselves in a pickle like this and they needed someone to help to make the decision as to whether someone was appropriately attired or not, that I would be very happy to step in and take care of that, and I'm very bummed that they didn't call me.
What we need is Southwest to have like the old courtesy jacket things. We just need a gazillion Airplane Geeks T-shirts. So when someone's offensive and doesn't want to fly, we just Southwest will pull out an Airplane Geeks T-shirt and give it to them so they can fly on the flight without any disruption of service, like you'd give an old a guy without a jacket a smoking jacket to go to a fine restaurant in Manhattan,
or in all, I mean, considering our guest, if they had boxes the size of people, they could say, if you want to fly on our airplane, we're going to put you in the box and tie you down in
and ship
7A.
You UPS.
Yeah, well, you don't even have to ship you. It could just be a UPS box and put you in the seat and tie you down, and then the, you know, Southwest could say that they're working closely with UPS. What do you think, Mike?
Well, you know, the reason why we like the fly boxes is they don't cause issues like this. we don't ship people, but, you know, we do ship people's luggage if they don't want to pay bag fares. Fortunately, Southwest is very good about that, but some other carriers do charge, and if people want to avoid those charges, we would be happy to ship their boxes to their vacation or business destination.
Mm-hmm. And, Mike, has UPS actually seen an upswing of people shipping luggage?
We have, actually. When you go out to the hub, occasionally you'll see a suitcase going through the sort. A lot of people will come into our UPS store locations and ship luggage, yeah.
Yeah, that can actually be quite a convenient way to travel. Just, you know, you turn it over before you ever get to the airport, and it's you know, pick it up on the other side.
That's waiting for you at your hotel or your beach house or wherever you happen to be going.
Has anybody ever tried to ship themselves in a box? I mean, we're talking about people in a box. But, I mean, has anyone ever actually tried to do that for whatever reason?
Not successfully.
Okay.
It has happened a couple of times, and those people were intercepted, fortunately for everybody involved, because at 30,000 feet in a cargo hold, it's a little cold.
Yeah. Are the cargo holds pressurized?
They are actually pressurized, and they are temperature controlled, the main decks.
Huh, okay.
Well, I guess we've moved into our main topic. Should we just keep going?
I think we should. So, again, we're with Mike Manjo. Mike is the public relations manager for UPS Airlines. Mike, how long have you been with UPS?
20 years.
And what kind of positions have you held? Have you been in the same kind of role, or have you done some different things?
UPS is a company that believes in moving people around. So I've been here 20 years, and I think I've had 7 or 8 different jobs. They've all kind of revolved around communications. But I've done everything from write technical manuals for maintenance systems to develop training curricula to work on our employee newspaper to public relations, all kinds of stuff.
Now, maybe we could talk a little bit about the UPS fleet. I mean, we mentioned the number of airports and the number of flights at the beginning of the show. But I understand UPS has, looks like, over 200 aircraft, Airbus, Boeing, Douglas. Is it just the three, or do you have others as well?
We currently have 229 heavy jets. We have 9 on order. We operate 5 different fleet types. We have our oldest and largest fleet types is 757. We have 75 of those. We have 50 767s, and with 9 more on order coming new from Boeing. We operate 53 A300s from Airbus, 13 747-400 aircraft, and 38 MD-11s. The last two are our primary international overwater aircraft. The 767 does a little bit of everything. It's an incredibly versatile airplane. And we use the A300 and the 75 mostly for intra-theater kind of operations, shorter routes, shorter hauls, that kind of stuff.
So is because you have such a spectrum of airframers and also engine types. I mean, you've got Pratt & Whitney and GE, Rolls-Royce, kind of cover all the ground. So is it a matter of, I guess what I'm asking is, what's the balance between fleet commonality that maybe airlines sometimes look at and just, you know, the right airplane for the right job? How does UPS view that?
We certainly try to take both factors into account to the extent that we can. You know, for example, when you talk commonality, our crew members who can fly the 7.5 can also fly the 7.6. You get the same type rating for both of those, for example. Mm-hmm. Our 747s and many of our MDs have the CF6 engines. Right. So we do try to be common where we can. But ultimately, it comes down to the mission at hand.
to fly between Louisville and, say, Roanoke, Virginia, you need a smaller plane, so you can use a narrow body like a 757 to fly between Louisville and Chicago and Orlando. More demand, so you need a wide body like an A300 to fly around the world. We have 20 around the world frequencies in a week. You need a 747 or an MD-11 to reach those ranges. So we look at the mission and acquire or convert accordingly.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's another issue I wanted to ask about is where these planes come from. Because I guess you have options, right? You can buy new, new either as a freighter or not, and if not, convert it. Or you can buy something on the market that's used, and maybe it's a freighter, or maybe it has to be converted. There again, do you kind of select from amongst all those options?
Mm-hmm. First, we start with our long-range forecast for package demand, and then we look at what our lift mix is. And when we determine there's a gap between the kind of small packages or heavy air freight we think we need and the aircraft that we have, then we go out and make either a purchase or a conversion decision. And we look at go out and look at what's available. We look at things like safety record, reliability, payload, flight characteristics, projected operating cost, things like that. And then we run that through a whole team of pilots, mechanics, finance experts, industrial engineers, and come up with a solution. In some cases, that is to buy a new production aircraft, like we have with our 767s, or in some cases, it's a conversion. Our 38 MD-11s are all converted from passenger configuration to cargo. So, and over the years, each case is different. We converted quite a few 727s and DC-8s and 747-100s and 200s in the past. Hmm. We have more production freighters now, I think, than we used to, but it's a mix.
Hey, Mike, question. What do you do as the year goes on? I'm sure that you do a heck of a lot more flights between October and January 1st than you do the rest of the year. How do you accomplish helping Santa in the holiday season?
We are definitely Santa's big helpers. We'll see our express volume in a couple weeks before Christmas double in some cases. Typically we'll do 1.5 to 2 million air express packages normally throughout the year. We might get to 3 or even 4 million in some cases around Christmas. We put up additional flights. We lease aircraft. Typically it's in the vicinity of 30 from other carriers. And make it happen.
You know, Mike, we've talked about a couple of things, including biofuels and things like that, green aviation. What's going on at UPS these days with respect to helping protect the environment?
Well, we are a large transportation company, but we do work very hard to try to leave a small footprint. We are really active in a number of ways to try to reduce our carbon footprint, save fuel, be as quiet as we can be. We recently put out our sustainability report. We are already the most fuel efficient and have the smallest carbon footprint in the cargo sector, but we've committed to reduce our carbon footprint by another 20% by 2020.
Wow, that's a big drop.
Well, it's something we take very seriously. We believe in sustainable business, and if we don't take care of the planet, we won't have customers to serve in the future. So we look forward to that. But we're doing all kinds of different things. We have computer-optimized flight routes that we use. We have systems for monitoring our taxi times, so we minimize fuel burn on the ground. We do things with special paint products to minimize the weight of paint on an aircraft.
Really? That's some kind of like lightweight paint or something? Or?
There are some chemical treatments that you can do that minimize the number of coats of paint you need to put on an aircraft.
Huh.
When you paint a big jumbo jet like the kind we have, the paint alone can weigh 300 pounds on a fuselage. Hmm. So less paint is less weight, burns less fuel.
Interesting.
We wash our engines regularly to keep them running clean. We do experiment with biodiesel, particularly with our ground support vehicles, and we're also part of a coalition looking at ways to make that more feasible for aircraft to use. You know, from a quiet perspective, I believe we were the first cargo airline. I'm not sure if we were the first overall airline, but I know we were the first cargo carrier to be stage 3 compliant in terms of noise. And then again with stage 4, since we do a lot of our flying at night, we do try to be good neighbors to our folks near our airports, and we do things like continuous descent approaches where aircraft kind of glide in at idle thrust as opposed to stepping down where we can do that. We do some contraflow approaches here at our main airport, our air hub in Louisville, Kentucky, where we fly in over the less crowded rural areas as opposed to the from south of our hub as opposed to the urban areas of the north. So we do quite a few things to try to take care of the world around us.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, one thing that we've also talked about that's generated some lively discussion is the European emissions trading scheme. I don't know if you can speak to that, but are cargo flights impacted the same as passenger aircraft in that? Do you know?
Yes, we are. And you know, a lot like all North American flight carriers, it's not something that we are in favor of and hope that we can figure out something that's more palatable for everybody.
Hmm. Yeah, and if I can add one thing, I think we have a comment coming up later on from one of our listeners about that same issue. And as Mike rightly pointed out, there are two issues there. There is the sort of that corporate or personal goal that says we've got to save the planet, which is what we started that discussion with when we had Robbie a couple of weeks ago. And then there is the do you think the emissions scheme tax or whatever you want to call it is fair? And you can believe in one without believing in the other.
Yeah, sure.
And I think it's really important that people do that. I mean, I'm going to be political for a second. It's like being against healthcare, but how can you be against saving the planet? Now, how it got that way or the best way to fix it, maybe that's another discussion.
Right, right.
But I don't see how people can actually be not in favor of that concept.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think everybody wants to or should want to do the right thing in terms of the environment. You know, we believe that the solutions best come from the carrier side as opposed to regulatory side. The fact is, when you look at, because so much of this comes back to fuel burn, it's simply good business to be fuel efficient because airplanes burn so much fuel. So it is an airline's own best interest to be as fuel efficient and cost efficient and, you know, by result green as they can be.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the pilots a little bit. Are the kinds of pilots that work for a company, that fly for a company like UPS, are they different kinds of folks than pilots who like to fly passenger flights? Is there a kind of a fundamental difference in the kind of pilot that is attracted to each, do you think?
Well, you know what's really interesting is when I first started UPS many years ago, the passenger guys kind of looked down on the cargo pilots, and, you know, you were carrying boxes in the middle of the night and, you know, you guys are kind of not at the same level we are. As the passenger carriers have struggled mightily over the past decade, 15 years in particular, UPS and FedEx jobs are now the top jobs in the industry. When you look at pay, benefits, stability, all those sorts of things, I think right now we're number one and FedEx is right behind us. So those jobs have become much more attractive. In terms of the men and women who fly our jets, a really great group of people. I'm almost universally impressed with them when I'm over at our training center or jump seating or whatnot. They do a great job, highly professional, safe, on time. They do good work.
Is the UPS training center, is that to maintain proficiency, or do you also train people from the beginning?
It is to maintain proficiency. You go there for recurrent training 2 days a year. You also, anytime you switch fleets or seats, you go in the schoolhouse for a couple months and do your FAA required training. We have classrooms. We have 8 full flight simulators, and it's basically our own kind of pilot university.
And where do the pilots come from? Do they come from airlines or main lines or regionals or other kinds of places?
A little bit of everything. I believe about 20 to 25% are ex-military. We have a number who come up through the regional carriers, and then we have some who have made the jump from mainline passenger carriers over to cargo.
I want to talk about some of the anniversaries that UPS has coming up. But before we get into that, just sort of one more or a kind of follow-up question on this topic we're discussing. We have a number of younger folks who are interested in pursuing some kind of a career in aviation. Is UPS an example of a place that folks can consider? Just, I mean, just in general, and not necessarily as pilots, but if you like aviation, is the aviation group within UPS kind of of sufficient size that it could be a potential entry point for some folks?
Absolutely, we have I believe 15,000 to 17,000 people who are employed in our air division in different capacities. That's everywhere from we've about 2,600 pilots. About 1,200 mechanics, a number of people who are aviation engineers or are engaged in other support functions, whether that be human resources, finance, that kind of stuff, specifically supporting our airline. So it is a business where you can certainly have a career, and I think if you look at the demographics, the boomers are getting ready to retire, which is going to create some opportunities down the road. In the near future, I would tell young folks to be kind of patient, because the economy being what it is and the boomers aren't gone just yet, things probably will be a little lean for a few years. But I believe, from what I understand, there will be a definite need for pilots, mechanics, and other professionals in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, that's great. The medium and long-term outlook does seem to be pretty bright for folks who are looking for an aviation career. If we can just get out of this this situation that we're in right now, that would help.
I have a 11-year-old son, and I tell him all the time, something you ought to consider. You make a nice 6-figure salary, work 15 days a month, and get to see the world. It's not a bad gig.
Yeah. All right. So we're recording this on August 27th, and tomorrow, August 28th, is, I understand, Mike, a kind of an interesting milestone for UPS.
That's right. August 28th is what we call Founders Day, and that is the day that UPS started. We started as a bicycle messenger service in the basement of a Seattle bar in 1907. Two teenagers borrowed $100 from a family friend and started what would become a 398,000-person, 220-country-serving international logistics empire.
Wow.
It's kind of like the Airplane Geeks, actually.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing thing. Jim Casey was the man who really, of the two, another gentleman named Claude Ryan, he was with Jim at the start and then bowed out a few years later, but Jim was the man who really carried it forward, and he started this little messenger service and gradually grew and grew in through Seattle. Then they kind of moved down the West Coast over time in the 1920s, and then jumped over to the East Coast and spent the first 70 years or so knitting together the ground network that everybody knows so well, with the friendly driver who comes to the door, right, here in the United States. And then we spent the last 30 years going international and adding another 200 countries to what we do, and starting an airline and a logistics business and finance and a number of other sidelines that we're into as well.
When the airline started 30 years ago, do you recall, well, not recall, but well, maybe, what was the first aircraft that UPS used?
DC-8.
Ah.
We had it was a 727. We had some that we owned, but we had to use several carriers to actually fly them for us. And then after about 5 years or so of doing that, we determined that it was time to start our own airline under our own certificate and put the shield on tails and whatnot. Mm.
So who flew the airplanes for you guys?
Orion.
Oh,
yeah. I believe Evergreen. There were five smaller carriers who we used, and I don't know all five of them off the top of my head. There are a few pilots still around who actually flew for those carriers, and are still with us today.
But now, when did you guys get rid of the DC-8s?
We flew DC-8s up until 2008, and it was really sad to see them go. They were great old planes.
You know, I have a question. Now, when an airline like you guys, had, and how many DC-8s did you say you had?
At the end, we had 46 or 48, but at one time, we had quite a few more.
Well, when that happens and they decide it's time for this particular airplane to hit the road, do you guys kind of go into the airplane brokerage business too then, or is that something that you pretty much farm out to some other organization to get rid of the old airplanes?
We have some folks with our finance function who buy and sell airplanes. It's one of their responsibilities. And so we had a group of folks who were attempting to find takers for the aircraft, either whole or parted out. And I believe they did a little bit of everything with those planes.
Wow.
We also, it was about 2008, the recession kind of drove a fleet modernization plan that we already had. But we parked a number of DC-8s, 727, 100s, and 200s, and some 747, 100s, and 200s that we were still flying. And it was emotional around the airline. They were, I remember we wrote a story in our employee publication that, you know, brought a tear to your good eye about a mechanic who had written goodbye old friend on the cockpit of a 727 before they flew it out to the desert. They would need planes. It was, you know, sad to see him go, but it was the right thing to do for the business.
Mike, I have just one last question from me. Just going back to conversions, because I've always wondered if, what's the process for performing a conversion? I mean, if you have a jet that's was delivered for a passenger service, what's involved in the conversion process? Is it just as simple as, you know, ripping out the seats and gutting the interior, or is there more to it?
We will take those planes to a vendor, for example, with our MD-11s. You know, they were all passenger aircraft. We bought them, you know, obviously when Boeing bought McDonnell Douglas, the MD-11 and the 747 were competing aircraft. So they stopped producing the MD-11s.
Right.
UPS and FedEx and cargo carriers kind of bought them up because they're a great small package aircraft. And we took them to a conversion facility. In this case, I believe it was SASCO in Singapore. And they got them, take them through, you know, all the way through a heavy check, and get them into cargo configuration with the load handling equipment, and cut the cargo door and all that kind of stuff, and then put them into service.
All right. Is there anything about UPS that we haven't touched on that you think our listeners might be interested in?
You know, some of the neat things that we do when you get a UPS package. Because of the way we have our air network set up, you can place an order with some of our customers as late as almost midnight, and we can have it at your door by 8 a.m. next morning. Because of our air network. We take people out to our Worldport hub all the time, and they have no idea, unless you happen to live in Louisville, and you see this huge thing, that there's a 5.2 million square foot building with 155 miles of conveyors. His packages can transit in an average time of about 13 minutes. And just all the technology that goes into getting the brown box to your doorstep is cool. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I still think it's cool.
It is phenomenal. I mean, I can recall many times when I've ordered something online, like you say, in the evening, and, I mean, not even paying necessarily for, you know, special expedited delivery. It's there the next day. It's you know, it's come from across the country or halfway across the country. It's just it's phenomenal.
And Mike, how far away do you think we are from same day delivery on products in various parts of the country?
We have had a service for a few years where we will do that for you if you want to pay us a lot of money.
Yeah.
It's next flight out service. We'll work with passenger airlines, and we'll figure out some way to get it to you as quickly as is humanly possible. It's an absolute premium service. But there is a British company called Shuttle, S-H-U-T-L, that is really doing some pioneering work in that right now. And in fact, we just bought a little stake in them, I believe. Hmm. But they are, you know, working on, you place a order on an online store and they'll get it to you within hours.
That's amazing.
In fact, that was my last question, because earlier you mentioned that UPS is involved in some other kinds of ventures. What other things do they do?
Basically, all you need to do is come up with an idea and if it's a product, a way to manufacture it, and we can work with you on financing, international brokerage, supply chain, which is helping you source raw materials, get them to your production facility, helping you distribute finished goods on the outside end. We'll work with you on returns management. We are supply chain solutions arm. We can do everything from we run call centers for some of our customers. We repair laptops for customers, program cell phones, tune guitars. We do all kinds of different things in the name of keeping our customers happy.
Wow, that's pretty comprehensive. Is this a kind of a service that's been offered by UPS for a while, or is this something new?
This is part of our supply chain solutions subsidiary that we started really probably 15 years ago, 20 years ago. It's a small business, and it's grown into a pretty good business in and of itself. You know, at UPS, I believe we made $55 billion last year, and the supply chain part of it was about $9 billion. So it's a growing part of the business, and basically it's kind of value-added. People, our customers know that we can ship their packages well, but they have other things that maybe they're not good at. But, you know, we do a lot of work with the healthcare business. Healthcare companies want to manufacture drugs and do research and development and treat patients, but they have to get products to hospitals or deal with storage and management of drugs, and we work with them on things like that. We help Ford get their cars from plants to dealerships. We do all kinds of things like that. That's, if it's not a company's core competency, and it's in the general realm of transportation or logistics, we'll be happy to help you out.
Mike, I know it really doesn't have to deal with aviation, but could you pass along to your ground transportation team that thank you so much for putting your grass skirts on the around the tires of the UPS trucks to reduce
the spray.
They are a joy to drive behind in rainstorms compared to all of the other 18-wheelers out on the world. I wish those grass skirts would transfer to everybody else.
Yeah,
We will definitely do that. You know, we take that road safety very, very seriously. We just had a driver who retired with over 50 years of safe driving, doing over the road hauling for us.
Wow. I bet Rob hasn't had 50. I know Rob's had 50 years of driving, but I bet he hasn't had 50 safe years of driving.
Wait, can I respond to that?
No. Well, you can if you like. Okay.
Hey, Mike, can you sing the UPS song? You know,
logistics.
I don't sing, but if you look in one of the commercials, I'm actually in it. So that's
really
my claim to fame with the commercial.
Cool. All right, Mike Mancho, thank you so much for spending some time with us. It's been a really interesting conversation. And if folks want to learn more about UPS, of course, there's ups.com. I have to believe that's the main website.
Correct. UPS.com has a ton of information if you're interested in our services. If you're interested in general information about our airline or other operations, we have a press room website, and it's www.pressroom.ups.com. It's a wealth of information.
Very good. Yeah, I did take a look at that the other day, and it was pretty interesting. And I know, or I believe UPS also has a blog.
Correct. You go to the press room website. It's right there.
There's a link right there.
Lots of fun and interesting facts about the company and things that customers can do, or people who are interested in aviation. From time to time, you know, we contribute things to the blog from the airline about interesting stuff we're doing.
And in terms of other social media, I think UPS is on Twitter at UPS.
Correct. At UPS, and we have a extensive Facebook page as well.
All right, fantastic. Again, Mike, thank you so much.
All right, gentlemen. Take care. Thanks for having me on.
And now with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 4, Episode number 25, August 25th through September 1st. The Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week, the Mitsubishi T2. Japan has had its own indigenous trainers since post-war. Fuji Heavy Industries T1 was a hybrid two-seat F-86 with an Orpheus engine from England. The T1 wasn't adequately training pilots for the F-104J and the F-4EJs. The new supersonic trainer was needed. In 1964, a proposal was put forth for a supersonic trainer. Japan looked at the Northrop T-38 Talon and the Sepcat Jaguar, or as they say in England, Jaguar. Japan settled...
Sorry. Go ahead.
However, the royalty payments requested by Sepcat for producing the Jaguar under license was exorbitant. Japan decided to produce its own indigenous trainer. In 1967, the XT2 was selected. It was designed by Dr. Kenji Ikeda. The XT2 took to the sky on July 20th, 1970. The T2 would become the first Japanese-designed aircraft to fly faster than the speed of sound. The T2 looks like a two-seat Jaguar, superficially. The fuselage is longer and its wingspan is shorter. The Japanese contracted to produce a Rolls-Royce Adur turbofan, the same engine that powers the Jaguar. The aircraft did not carry over the landing gear design either. The twin nose gear main and mains were replaced by single wheels due to the fact that Japan doesn't need off or rough field takeoffs. The single nose gear was eventually supplemented with a vertical fin in front of it because it disrupted the airflow and the aircraft would yaw to the right when landing gear would be deployed. One interesting aspect that was the cockpit was the ejection seats. The 00 Weber ES7J ejection seats, if deployed, would pop chafe, so the ground forces could get a radar ping for the search and rescue teams. This is really important considering most of Japanese training and operating areas for military aircraft are over the open ocean. The T2 came in two different versions, the T2Z or early type and the T2K. The main difference was the addition of a JM61A Vulcan cannon with 750 rounds of ammunition. The JM61A is a licensed-built version of the General Electric M61. Which in one variant or another is in every U.S. fighter in the inventory. The Ks were also equipped with the JAWG-11 radar. A license-built radar was the standard radar of the U.S. F-4 Phantoms. It was beneficial because the transition was to the F-4EJs. 28 of the unarmed Zs were built and 60 of the armed Ks were completed. An additional two aircraft were completed. However, they were converted into the prototypes of the Mitsubishi F-2 Maritime Interceptor. The T-2 turned blue in 1982. I'm a poet and don't know it. The JASAF demonstration team, Blue Impulse, took to flying the T-2s, and they replaced the F-86 at the time. The Blue Impulse flies a six-ship formation, much like the T-Birds or Blue Angels. In fact, it was after a tour of the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds that the head of the JASDAF, or Japanese Self-Defense Air Force, decided that they needed an aerobatic team and modeled it actually after the Thunderbirds. The team flew the T-2 and was until 1995, where it was replaced by the T-4. The most unusual T-2 to enter the inventory was the T-2 CCV, or control-configured vehicle. Mitsubishi added a vertical control surface behind the nose gear and canards in front of the wing. This was the
test fly-by-wire, or FBW, and enhance maneuverability. The T2 is not alone as being a test bed for CCV. Believe it or not, there has been an F-16, an F-15, an F-4, a B-52, and an F-104 configured as a control-configured aircraft, or CCV. The F-15 by McDonnell Douglas actually used the F-18 tailplanes as canards. The Germans took a second set of F-104G horizontals and bolted them to the fuselage to act as canards. The bottom line is to make the aircraft inherently unstable so they would be more agile. It also improved fly-by-wire controls. These experiments in the late 70s and early 80s led to our fifth-generation fighters, the Typhoon and Raptor. While only 90 aircraft were built, the T-2 brought the Japanese aircraft industry into the supersonic age. The T-2s were retired in 2006 and replaced by the Kawasaki T-4. So this week we'll run the randomizer, and the winner is... the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar.
Oh, we've had some, at least one listener hope that we would have that one come up in the rotation, so that's great.
We'll be talking about TriStars, and we'll be talking about TriStars in museums. This will make certain listeners with the aquatic name of fish very happy.
Cool. Look forward to it.
And now, from down under, here's Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer of the Plane Crazy Down Under.
Dateline, 27th of August, 2012.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 212. Well, Grant, a big week in aviation news this week, and we're going to start off by talking about Alan Joyce's bonus, or lack of it, mate. I don't think he's going to collect that extra $2.7 million.
Oh, mate, you mean he's going to have to stick with just his $2.3 million salary?
Oh, yes, how awful for him.
Oh, mate, my heart bleeds.
Yes, Qantas has racked up quite a sizable loss for the financial year, as they reported this week, and here's a report about that from the Australian Financial Network.
Qantas Airways has swung to a $244 million loss in the 2012 financial year, its first loss since being privatised. The carrier says its result was weighed down by record fuel costs and the grounding of the Qantas fleet last year. They pointed to deterioration in global aviation operating conditions as well. CEO Alan Joyce has forecast continued challenges in the next year, however, expects the airline to retain its 65% domestic market share and increase its domestic capacity by around 10%.
Lots of talk there, Grant, about domestic operations, and it just makes me wonder if this is part of a bigger strategy by Mr. Joyce and the board.
Definitely, mate. It's been on the cards for a while. They've been talking up how bad international is, even though they've not really been able to prove just exactly where the money's going within domestic international and Jetstar and some of the group expenses and things like that. Until now, they've never really had international as a separate entity for recording. Now, when everything's pretty bad, conveniently it's spat out on its own. I think they may be setting it up to either atrophy or at least reduce and repurpose. But everything is on Jetstar and domestic, the two shining lights of the group.
Absolutely, mate. And I think you keep talking about the A380 in Jetstar colours, and you know it's looking more and more likely. I mean, I wonder if the plan might not be just to push everything across to Jetstar for international over time, and basically Qantas will become what Australian Airlines was before they took it over. Oh, sorry, was that merged with? I can never remember.
Well, the other aspect is that Joyce has also cancelled 35 of Qantas Group's 787 order. That's for the 787-9s. They're still getting 15 of the Dash 8s. They will, of course, go to Jetstar to be used on their routes, which will free up those A330s to come back in and replace the gas-guzzling 767s on the domestic runs. But looking at it, mate, the remaining 787 orders they've got are all options. And thanks to some very cunning crafting of the original order and a few barrels that they've had Boeing over since the 787's been running later and later, they've been able to actually get a big chunk of cash from Boeing, as well as defer a big payment of cash thanks to this cancellation of 35 787-9s. And they've also sort of kept their position in line with the options for 2016. So that little bit is kind of cunning and cool, but the share market sort of put the price up when they realized they were getting all this cash in. But a few days later, the price started to come back down as people started to realize that, well, hang on, until these new 787s are across the board, they're going to be using very fuel guzzling and maintenance expensive 747-400s and 767s. So perhaps a short-term gain, but a long-term operational cost coming through by delaying those 787s.
And despite all the bad press that this announcement received in many of the media outlets here in Australia this week, Alan Joyce has actually been quoted as saying that the board has been making a lot of right decisions. Well, I hope he knows what he's doing, because, you know, I don't see too many right decisions.
I see lots of right decisions right out there, left, right out of it, all those kind of ones.
Yes. And as we keep saying, Grant, I mean, we always sound like we're so anti-Qantas, and we're actually not. We love Qantas. We just don't want to see it going downhill like this.
Yeah, mate, it's been a shame to watch it over the last 10 years as it's changed and moved downwards to the eyes of many. What it once was is definitely not what it is now, and we're kind of hanging out hope that it will recover for the future. But honestly, I don't know that it's going to be any more than domestic wall too soon, I'm afraid.
Plenty more Qantas news coming up for the remainder of this year, I'm sure. But let's move on to defence for now, Grant, and you know, let's talk about some positive news. We reported earlier in the year that many of the Royal Australian Air Force's FA-18F Super Hornets were pre-wired to be converted into the EA-18G Growler specs, and the government has now confirmed that they are going to go ahead with that project at the cost of $1.5 billion.
That's right, mate. They pre-wired 12 of the 24 F-18 airframes to be able to have the plumbing to support being the Growler, and they're now proceeding to purchase the ALQ jammer pods and various other modules required to allow a number of F-18s to operate as Growlers. Now, whether that means they'll have 12 simultaneous Growlers or whether they'll just have 12 aircraft that can swap in and out as required, and maybe just have 3 or 4, maybe 6 that can fly at any one time as Growlers, whole different thing. But yeah, they are progressing. They're spending a big chunk of money, and we're going to have a capability that we've needed for quite some time.
Defence Minister Stephen Smith said last week that these aircraft will be available for operations from 2018, which is significant in itself, Grant, because that's also the planned date for the introduction of the F-35s, should they ever come.
Yeah, mate. There's been a number of people saying we won't operate a 2-aircraft fleet for once the F-35s come on. I think we'll wind up with definitely Growlers and F-35s, maybe even Super Hornets, Growlers and 35s.
Now, moving on to the field of training now, and Griffith University up there in Queensland has just announced that it's partnering with Cathay Pacific for its cadet program. That's really positive news.
It's pretty cool, isn't it? Griffith University, once just a campus within the Nathan area of Brisbane, very close to the CBD, and a place I went to university when I was just out of high school. That has expanded, picked up a few TAFEs, grown into a bit of a conglomerate of university and college environments. They offer an aviation course, and students who complete their commercial rating with the Griffith University aviation course and have the number of hours and the right results are eligible to enter Cathay Pacific's Advanced Entry Cadet Program.
And according to this article here, Grant, that we read in australianaviation.com.au, it says it's expected that demand for available places, up to 120 of them, in fact, in the first year, will be highly competitive. I think that will be an understatement, Grant. In fact, I think I might just apply for it myself.
Oh, mate, I think you definitely should. It'd be a wonderful way for you to get back in and get behind the yoke of something huge, or the side stick, as the case may be. But yeah, it's a great way of bringing up pilots to work their way through the ranks. We're seeing it again and again, these cadet programs, some of which offer scholarships, some of which offer offsetting your payment of your fees until you're actually earning with the airline, some combination of both. I think that's the way it's going to go in the future. It's getting more and more expensive to be a student pilot, working your way towards those magic 1,500 hours as a right-hand seater. So this is the way to go. Well done. I think it's great that the university and Cathay Pacific are working together.
Yeah, and absolutely, Grant. And I tell you what, if some of those students can't get on with the Cathay Pacific program, they might end up flying for Etihad or Virgin Australia, or who knows, the way things are going, maybe both.
Etihad or Eti Virgin? Yes, who knows? But yeah, they are working quite well together. Etihad now has 6.1% of Virgin's available stock. They were at around 5%. They got clearance to go up to 10%. So they're well on track, climbing towards 10% ownership of Virgin. That is, of course, Virgin Australia's domestic arm, which is allowed to have up to 100% ownership by foreign holders. And Etihad have said that one day they hope to get to 19%, which is quite a sizable chunk.
Yeah, it's a very sizable chunk, and of course, as you mentioned there, it would need further approval from the government for that to happen. Interestingly, as we mentioned a few episodes back when this story first came to light, Etihad's been investing in a lot of airlines, including Air Seychelles, Aer Lingus, and Air Berlin there in Germany. So quite a sizable stable there. And an interesting thing about all these Middle Eastern carriers that are operating in our part of the world at the moment is that when you come to West Coast operations here from Australia, there's actually more Middle Eastern carriers operating from the West Coast of Australia than there are Australian carriers, so I find that quite astounding.
There certainly are between the Middle Eastern and the Asian carriers, such as China Southern and the Singapore and Cathay and those groups, as well as Etihad and Emirates and Qatar. A lot of activity in the West Coast and the whole of Australia, in fact. As Qantas is reducing its capacity on the international routes, these other airlines are stepping up and taking over. It's in fact, we're seeing a boom in the number of people coming to and from Australia. And as Qantas pulls back, everyone else just steps in to take up the load.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. Peter Johnson's up next with Across the Pond. And Grant, I think he's talking about across the pond from us, talking about operations in India.
Today, we welcome back Rohit Rao from Aeroblogger to talk to us about aviation in India. Rohit, welcome back across the pond.
Thank you.
Well, today Rohit is actually calling us from the US, but closer to home. Rohit, what's been happening to the airline industry in the past few months since we last talked?
Well, there's been a lot that's gone on in the past few months. Kingfisher has continued its spiral downwards. This last quarter, they actually reported a loss that was three times their revenue. So they had a negative 300% margin, which is absolutely atrocious. I don't get how they are continuing operations like this. Then there's been the Air India pilot strike and all of that. That's created a lot of problems operationally for Air India, and it's also cut down on capacity out of India.
Right.
And that's actually led to much higher yields out of India for international carriers. Its prices have gone through the roof with the cutting capacity.
Right.
There's been some more startups which have shown themselves and then disappeared. There's Volk Airlines, which we talked about last time. They pretty much disappeared. They're still hiring, but nobody seems to know what they're doing. They haven't approached the government for anything. No approvals, NOC, nothing.
Yeah.
And there are a couple others like that, ABC Aviation and Air Costa, who were planning to start up with Q400s, now are starting up with jets, apparently, but they have no clue where they're going to get the jets from or what the time frame is anymore.
Gosh, it's almost unbelievable, isn't it?
Well, yeah, everybody is like so disorganized. Everyone thinks, oh my God, there's such a big opportunity with Indian aviation right now.
Yeah.
But I'm actually a bit skeptical about that. There's a lot of overcapacity in the market. Fares are very low. Yields are terrible right now.
Right.
So I'm not sure. The only exception where there's actually an opportunity is in the regional sector, which is still rather underserved.
Okay, we'll come back to that. But I read recently that there's been a bit of a pilot shortage hitting some of the carriers, and that there are some short-term contracts from pilots abroad. Is this sustainable given the growth potential?
Well, in Asia, pretty much all of Asia, there's been a pilot shortage thanks to the boom in air travel. People can suddenly afford to fly, so growth has been very strong. But there isn't enough support in terms of training pilots. There
right.
aren't that pilot schools, and the ones which exist aren't very good quality.
Yeah.
So yes, there is a pilot shortage in Asia, especially on the wide bodies, which require a lot of experience.
Yeah, okay.
So in India specifically, it's not that bad. Airlines haven't really been forced to recruit short-term pilots. India actually has two pretty decent training schools which are notable. IGRUA is the biggest one, Indira Gandhi Rashtriya Udana Academy.
Right.
And that one has for years been supporting Air India and Indian Airlines with all of their pilot needs. And it's a very high-quality institution. And now that Air India is facing some financial difficulties, some of the private carriers like IndiGo have also started recruiting from there.
Right, okay. And I've continued to track your website, Aeroblogger. Very, very interesting website. I'm enjoying it. And last week you reported on yet another new airline, Air Mantra. Is there room for another small regional carrier?
Yes, I do think that Air Mantra actually is cashing in on an opportunity which it might do well in. The regional market, the major carriers don't really have anything smaller than a Q400 and ATR. Those are the smallest.
Yeah.
So Air Mantra using these beach craft is actually able to serve the smaller routes in smaller regional routes without really going head-on against the major carriers. Now, they've started in some routes in Punjab and northwest India.
Yeah.
I think that if they manage themselves well and get a good operation and market themselves well so that they can attract passengers, it could be very successful. The fares on these routes are high. The one thing which might kill them, though, is SpiceJet. With their Q400s, they've been trying to expand very aggressively in North India.
Yeah.
I think SpiceJet, with their much larger marketing and their much larger operation, will be able to kill Air Mantra without much difficulty if they try.
Oh, well, we'll watch that one with interest and see if the next time we talk, they're still around. And so finally, to Air India, as we record this, they have the imminent arrival of their new 787s, literally today or tomorrow. We expect to hear they're being delivered. What routes are Air India going to use these aircraft on?
Well, firstly, the delivery, which was supposed to happen today, has been pushed back yet again.
Right.
The finance ministry apparently is refusing to sign off on the delivery payment, and Boeing obviously can't hand over the keys until that happens.
Right, okay.
Not really sure why the finance ministry is declining this. It might be some paperwork issues or some bureaucrat on a power trip, who knows.
Yeah.
But it's really disappointing. Air India management is absolutely furious over this new development. But it's expected to come in the next week or two, and Air India is hoping for the first two deliveries by the end of August.
Right, okay. And where will they be using these aircraft?
Well, the only concrete route which Air India has announced for the 787 is to fly to Australia, actually.
Oh, right, okay.
Be flying Delhi, Sydney, Melbourne, Delhi.
Okay. I was really secretly hoping they were going to come to the UK, actually. But
no, actually, there's a good chance of that. With the Delhi-Sydney-Melbourne route actually connects to the former Air India 115 and 116.
Yeah.
With the early morning departure out of Delhi to London.
Right, and okay.
Continued. We think that there's a good chance that flight will be reintroduced on the 787 in order to facilitate Kangaroo route connections.
Well, Rohit, thank you again for sharing with us your experience of the sector. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online at my website, aeroblogger.com, on Facebook at facebook.com/aeroblogger, and on Twitter at twitter.com/TheAeroBlogger.
And just a reminder for anyone listening, if you haven't been to the AeroBlogger website, it's well worth a read. It's a very refreshing view on aviation in not only Asia, but across the world. Rohit, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
You know, I got an email from Peter, and both he and Rohit wanted to mention that after they had recorded that, the Air India 787 deliveries have actually now begun. So the problem has apparently been cleared up, and the deliveries have started. Also, I wanted to mention dedication. I don't think you guys know, but Steve and Grant ran into some pretty heavy technical problems unexpectedly. And it actually took them three tries, at least three tries that I know of, over I'm not sure how many days to get the Australia desk report together. So we really, really want to thank Steve and Grant for the great effort to come through for the show.
Well, you know what? If those guys were a little nicer to the kangaroos in the neighborhood, this kind of thing wouldn't happen. So I think it's all kind of come back to haunt them myself.
You think that's it, huh?
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. What I actually thought was interesting about Steve and Grant's report was that Steve has just, have you noticed? He doesn't even just end the show. He takes it upon himself to introduce the next segment.
That's right.
Like he's in charge. I mean, jeez.
Yeah, well, the next step would be him in the closing introducing a Grill the Geeks segment. Are you guys ready for some Grill the Geeks questions? We haven't done this in a few weeks.
No, yeah.
All right, let's see if we can do a couple maybe. I've got one from our good friend Ian Kershaw. Now,
hold on, Max. I need to tell you. I need to pay up. I said it was going to be 6 or 7 weeks before Rob would realize that we've been doing live throwovers.
Yeah, that's right.
I owe you money. I'm sorry. You got right. It in two.
Yeah, that's pretty good, huh? All right, we'll explain it to you later, Rob.
And who are these Steve and Grant guys?
That's
the other thing I want to know. Well, you guys explain it.
All right, let's go back to Ian Kershaw. Now, listen, this has got a kind of a long lead-in, so you have to pay attention. Ian writes, may I add a little piece on the fallen gnat? That's something we talked about. No, it's quite a few issues ago, I think. Quite a few episodes ago. He says, the single-seat pocket fighter was the Midge, and while the RAF did not buy any, Finland bought a few, and as you rightly pointed out, India adopted it. The gnat...
Ajit.
Huh?
And he adopted it as the Ajit, A-J-E-E-T.
Right, that's right. I remember that. We talked about that. So Ian says the gnat was the two-seat trainer as used by the RAF as an advanced trainer, with its real claim to fame, never mind the movies, was its use by the RAF demonstration team, the Red Arrows. Now, okay, here's the question. And, oh, Dave Gilmore owned and flew one. Here's the question. Who
painted yellow and it was the Yellow Jackets.
The question is, who is Dave Gilmore?
Oh, who is Dave Gilmore?
Yeah. Who is Dave Gilmore?
Of Pink Floyd fame?
The what? Of Pink Floyd fame?
Of Pink Floyd fame. David Gilmore.
Wow.
Guitarist.
You might be right. All right. Let's see what Ian says. Let me open up his answer here. Let's see. Yes. Lead guitarist, Pink Floyd. Yes, really. He says, I have an old magazine with his gnat in it, painted as one of the Yellow Jackets. Who are they? Another Grill the Geeks question. Will it never end? So, yeah.
Jackets were the predecessor of the Red Arrows. Their airplanes were yellow with black stripes. When David Gilmore bought his gnat, he put it in yellow and black stripes to honor the Yellow Jackets.
Did he fly it to the other side of the moon? I guess that was the dark side of the moon.
But there is a lovely song by Pink Floyd that's got all sorts of Gilmore's practicing on learning to fly.
Yeah. Wow, I didn't know that. That's or if I did.
That's all his live transmission.
What was that, back in the 70s?
Yeah.
Oh, that's why I don't remember it. Okay, next.
See, and I thought, see where I thought that whole thing was going? Yeah. Is I thought Ian was going to make some kind of a comment like he was really sad that they're not using those airplanes anymore.
Oh, God. Okay.
But luckily, Ian didn't, because he's way more sophisticated than that.
He sure certainly is. All right, let's do one more. This is from Richard. This is a shorter question. When was the first round-the-world passenger trip by an aircraft? What was the route of flight and the equipment used and the duration? The first round-the-world passenger trip by an aircraft.
Well, I know it wasn't me.
No.
So you're safe there.
Well, let's see. I don't know. The Swoosh went around the world. The Graf Zeppelin went around the world. I'm working backwards. Amelia didn't go around the world. I'm stumped.
This was passenger around the world passenger trip by an aircraft. Let me see what Richard had to say.
If he says Graf Spee, I'm going to cry.
He says, let's see. He says the first round-the-world trip carrying passengers, not just crew members, was August 1929, when 20 passengers, some of whom paid up to $9,000 for a ticket, boarded the, get ready for this, the Graf Zeppelin at Lakehurst, New Jersey. The route. Okay.
So I was right. But
you was right.
But that's why I said, he said aircraft, and I was like,
So here's the route. Here's some interesting, he's got some interesting facts here, I think he says.
How long did that take?
The route, well, I think it's, let's see, the route was to Friedrichshafen, Germany, Tokyo, Los Angeles, and back to Lakehurst. He says Dr. Hugo Eckener was in command. Captain Ernst Lehmann, who would be killed in the crash of the Hindenburg at Lakehurst 8.5 years later, served as first officer for the flight. He says the leg from Germany to Tokyo went over northern Siberia and took 101 hours, 49 minutes, covering 7,297 miles. The entire trip, including stops, took, wow, get this, 21 days, 5 hours, and 31 minutes, and covered 20,651 miles. Actual flying time was 12 days and 11 minutes. He says much of the cost of the trip was bankrolled by William Randolph Hearst, who had 4 reporters amongst the passengers. Wow, fascinating. So thanks to Richard for that. That's really interesting. Well, David, nice job.
Hold on. I'm playing Dan Webb.
How do you do that?
Well, I'll show you in a moment.
You're looking up a spreadsheet.
Well, sort of. Okay. If in 1929 you purchased an item for $9,000.
Oh, this is a Dan Webb move. Yeah, go ahead.
The same item would cost in 2012 $120,581.05.
Wow. And what's the what's Bert Rutan charging to take a little trip up in the Spaceship One?
Couple of, is that a mil?
No, isn't it around?
No, I think it's $200,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
So that's not like gigantically out of proportion, right? An around the world trip back then, a little trip into space now, those are roughly equivalent.
Yeah, but he's not going to serve fine china and be able to have cigars and cognac.
Yeah, it's true.
And the Virgin airplane's only going to be in space for, what, 30 seconds or something? Or?
Yeah, not very long. Okay, let's move on to some listener mail. We've got a few minutes left. First one comes from Ripcord. He's got a comment about, Neil Armstrong. He said, I suppose you all have heard about his passing by now. The thing is, when I think of Apollo 11 and the subsequent missions, I am so angry at what we as a country threw away in canceling the Apollo program just as it was starting. What we have now, technologically, from Apollo versus what we could have had goes beyond mere words in one's imagination. Colonies on the moon, Mars, who knows? Politics and space, and for that matter, science, are a terrible, terrible mix, with both space and science losing out to partisan politics. Soon, all the Golden Age astronauts will be gone and become distant memories except for their biographies and mute displays in museums. I really wish I could go back 40 years or so and kick Nixon's rear end for even thinking about canceling Apollo. And then, I don't know, who can read Latin?
Sic ater ad astra.
And I think that roughly translates to something like, thus one goes to the stars. So thanks to Ripcord for that. Great email. We also got a audio message from Micah, from our friend Micah. Here he is.
Hi, everybody. This is Micah, recording to you here in northern New Jersey. And I just had to share what an amazing week it's been for me regarding aircraft and the airplane geeks. I had to drive down to New Jersey to work on Harriet's estate a little bit. But on the way down, I got to listen to episode 209.5 and 210. And David's episode, 209.5, coming from Oshkosh, was unbelievable. And I learned so much about the P-180 Avanti. Well, then, amazingly enough, while dealing with a realtor on the outside of my mother's house, I heard this strange aircraft noise. The house is right under the Teterboro approach, or the new traffic approach anyway. And I looked up, and sure enough, it was a P-180 Avanti. And I screamed, and the realtor, who I'd never met before, looked at me, couldn't figure out what was going on. And I said, that's a P-180 Avanti. I just learned about that. It's a counter-rotating twin turboprop aircraft with the widest cabin of any aircraft, any turboprop aircraft in available. I went on and on and on, and she said, oh, I'm sorry I missed it. And then another one came in right after it, two in a row. It was beautiful to see, amazing to hear. And one of the things that it really did show me, now that I saw the P-180 Avanti, is that when I sent you a recording the last time, telling you how delighted I was to see a Beechcraft Starship, well, I now know for sure it was a Beechcraft Starship. Well, later in the week, today in fact, which is Saturday, I decided to drive up to the Greenwood Lake Airport, where they have a beautiful constellation as the pilot's lounge. I sat there, watched some general aviation go by, had lunch, and just had a great time. I came back to turn on the radio, and I heard that one of our heroes, I think all of our heroes, died, Neil Armstrong, not only an incredible astronaut, the first man on the moon, but one of the last men astronauts to be an incredible pilot. He was an amazing X-15 pilot, as we all know, among many other things. But I had to call, had to share it with you, let you know that I'm thinking about you, thanking you all for your friendship and help, and looking forward to hearing more episodes. Have a great week, and we'll be in touch. Mike is signing off from here in northern New Jersey.
Well, thank you so much, Micah. That's a great, great report from New Jersey. Boy, Avantis. I think
it's a... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think it's a great thing that we can hear from somebody like Mike, and it proves that our Airplane Geeks show, Mind Meld, has been working on listeners, because we have indeed converted Micah over to one of us.
I think that's true. But, you know, I think Ripcord is you know, working his
fast
mojo on
up.
Us. Yeah, he is. Yes. Well, because
of course,
somehow...
Mike is still the guy. Mike is still the man in Maine.
He's our main man. Yes, yes. Well, Ripcord somehow snuck in two emails in this one episode.
I kind of noticed that.
But this is a good one. This is he says, this is a hate mail directed at that Wookiee, a.k.a. David Vanderhoof.
The Wookiee.
Because he got a ride in an SNJ and I didn't. Just kidding, not really. No, really, what a great opportunity to take advantage of, and I am really happy for him to have had that experience. I have a question. What did it smell like in the cockpit? Was it a combination of avgas, hydraulic fluid, oil, hot metal, and more? That may be a strange question in the face of it, but the smell is what I remember from some of my rides in the DC-3, C-47s, a B-25, T-34B, the Havilland Beaver, T-29, etc. Odd thing to remember, but the smell of an old airplane is quite distinctive, as is the smell of something that has a radial engine versus inline, and avgas versus jet fuel. Very cool. Mr. Vanderhoof, congrats. And that's from Ripcord. So, David, what do you got to say about the smell of your little ride?
I have, since I was sent this email, I've been trying to think of it. I really can't. Well, all I remember is salt air, unfortunately, because we are flying over the ocean. Now, the reason why I could smell salt air was because it was an open cockpit. But, yeah, the smell... I know what he's talking about because I've been in a B-25 and it's got its own smell, and airplanes have personalities and they get their own little quirks, I think what shook me most about the flight was how comfortable I was in the cockpit, in the rear cockpit. It was, as aptly described, while I'm not as large as I used to be, I am 6'4". And
hence Wookie.
Yeah, and hence I was really worried that I was going to get in the back seat of this airplane and be like flying a normal airliner flight where my knees are trying to insert themselves down my throat. It was surprisingly comfortable. I wasn't sitting anywhere near the rudder pedals, and that was what really took me about the whole thing.
besides the fact I was sort of taking mental notes to see if I could, when I went back home and looked at my model text and if I had gotten the interior right. But as far as smell goes, I hate to say it, Ripcord, but there wasn't really anything memorable about the smell. I guess I'm just a more of a visual guy and not used to using my nose.
All right. Since you got nothing on the smell of an SNJ, how about this? What's the smell like in the inside of Rob's Mini?
You guys are just mean.
He's not answering,
though. You just like to set me up. I mean, first it's Stephen Grant, and how much money you think you can make off of the fact that I don't pay attention to everything. And now there's another cruel comment about my little car, Eddie.
Now, actually, Eddie does not smell bad, but part of that is because the last ride I had in Eddie, he threw me in the back seat with all of the stuff. So basically, it was too tight for me to breathe. So I wouldn't be able to.
Okay.
That's true, because we had Ravi in the front seat during a torrential rainstorm.
So my answer is I really won't attest to Eddie. Rob's office smells like Simba, but I'll give Eddie it smells like a car, and maybe next time I won't be able to have to hold my breath in the back seat.
All right. So I guess the lesson from this is for our listeners is no more questions for David that are olfactory in nature.
Because it stinks.
All right. Let's move along really quickly. Note from Ben. This was interesting. Ben sent along some links. This is on the Heathrow transportation pods. And I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at some of these videos, but these are small electric vehicles, no drivers. They can fit, I think he said, up to four people plus luggage. And it's a much faster transportation method from parking to the terminals than waiting for the bus. So thanks to Ben for that. Interesting. That might be interesting to kind of explore in a little more detail sometime. Also, Min sent us a link to a video. This is a video of the C-17 that landed at the wrong airport, landing at something considerably smaller than its intended destination, I presume. And it's interesting when you're watching this video, you can hear the sounds and the voices of the people standing around watching this. And to me, it sounds like they're basically freaked out when this, from the first place, when the C-17 comes into their little airport, and then a little bit maybe panicked at what's going to happen because this is a short runway and the C-17 is a big airplane, and then amazed at how fast the thing stops in the short distance. So it's a fun little video, very short, but we'll put a link to that in the show notes also.
Yeah, that one's when they landed at Peter O'Knight Airport down there in beautiful Tampa. And you know, it's amazing how quickly an airplane can stop when the captain pulls the engines into about 6,000% reverse thrust and climbs on the brakes until the tires smoke, saying, "Oh, we're going to run out of runway." Just amazing what that adrenaline can do for you.
Yeah. I love that airplane. That's amazing.
And if you haven't seen a C-17 do a tactical landing, mm-hmm. basically they put it reverse thrust before they hit the ground. So it's quite impressive to watch the thing stop.
Yeah. Awesome. And we got an email from Ryan Hothersall. Ryan, who's got a great little website called ryanhothersall.net. And he commented on, we were talking about David, what David would do last time if he had millions of dollars, and he said he would put it into museums. And Ryan says, when David gets his millions and puts his name on the Smithsonian, could he please leave a little corner for me to put my models in? You know, David, if you were to make a donation like that, that's with all your models, a little corner is probably all that would be left for Ryan or anybody else.
I actually should go out and look at Ryan. He's far more of a prolific modeler than I am anymore, but he's got some cool stuff that's worth going out to his website and looking at. I am friends with him on Facebook, and it's always nice to see somebody modeling, because now that I have a podcasting life, my workbench kind of looks sorry looking and pathetic and calls to me. And then I get a call from my boss saying that he can't update his Facebook page. So thus I get sucked away from the modeling bench as usual. So
great. All right. I think it was last episode or some recent episode, I made a kind of a comment, maybe intended to be kind of a joke, when we were talking about flight planning. So I guess that would have been last episode. And I mentioned, I wondered if they do flight planning for balloons. And Grant McHaren wrote in, and yeah, they do. And there's a lot of it. It's kind of interesting. This is kind of long to go over. Maybe we can toss this on the Facebook page or something. But he looks at the wind conditions, WAC charts, topographical charts.
Hit it all up.
Lists of prohibited zones, pi reps, weight and balance, wind conditions, fuel on board. It just goes on and on. So, yeah. And
he goes out, licks his finger, sticks it in the air, and goes, okay, we're going to go that way.
You think that's it, huh? I don't know. Even after he's got his license now, he's got to do all those things now. And let's see. Finally, yes, from Trevor Smith, Desert Pilot. He says, last week, a listener wrote in about talking about the career path for Lufthansa pilots and that they did their pilot training in the Phoenix area. So Trevor says, well, being a native Phoenician myself, I can say that I've heard the Lufthansa pilots in the practice area a lot and talked for a few on the ramp. There are quite a few foreign training schools in the area, and I think they are one of the best. Very professional and most easy to understand on the radio. But what I always thought was really cool is that Lufthansa has their own private airfield southwest of Phoenix Mobile Airport. Rumor has it with its own ILS, too. Having landed at almost all the airports in the valley, I am always jealous when I fly over because I want to do a quick touch and go. And Trevor gave us a link to the airports that he's logged. And also, really interestingly, a link to Google Maps that is of the airport. And if you zoom in on it, you can literally see the Lufthansa written on it. So we'll put those links in the show notes. We're also anticipating, as it turns out, in a few weeks, a guest from Lufthansa. So Lufthansa has been in our episodes a lot lately, particularly with regard to training and some other things. So we hope to have someone from Lufthansa to talk to right on the show. All right, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank you all for listening. We really, really appreciate it. We do this for you. We'd like to thank our guest, Mike Mongeau. He's the public relations guy for UPS Airlines. And also our contributors, of course. We want to thank Grant McHaren and Steve Vischer again for coming through. And Peter Johnson.
Yay!
All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Oh, I was waiting for the Maxbot to ask me that. I guess that's not going to happen, huh?
Let me think about that.
Okay, jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, Jetwine on Facebook.
And David Vanderhoof.
DM Vanderhoof on Google+, DM Vanderhoof on Twitter, David Vanderhoof on Facebook, and my blog, whatjustflewby.com.
All right, thanks, guys. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Twitter and Google+ is Max Flight. Also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com with links to all the sites we mentioned on the podcast, listener comments. You can procure some Airplane Geeks t-shirts and find some other stuff. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook and also Google+. And we're also on Stitcher.com. If you'd like to stream us right to your mobile phone, you can do that there. If you want to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet will give you that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS01.
Another option, if you have recording capability, you can record your own message and email that to us. In fact, that's what Micah did for us this week. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. Cheers.
The Airplane Geeks podcast is sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn to fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight.
Sure. I was just going to say, can I just say there was nothing, was not anything like that ever. Wow. Well, anyway. All right. Sorry. Make me sound good, Max. That's the post-production part. I'm sorry, Mike. Go ahead.
Okay.
So you heard that big calamitous crunch, kerang, kabang,
huh? Oh, my God, yes.
What the heck was
that?
Yeah,
sorry. But, well, Simba usually lays here on the floor when I'm doing this. And you know what dogs do? They start chasing things in their sleep, and their feet are going.
Yeah,
and,
right. They start
and
twitching.
And he just kicked the table, and he knocked all this stuff off the table. And then it scared him, so he jumped up. And he came up under the table and knocked more stuff off the table took off like a rabbit into the other room. So anyway.
It was right in the middle. Mike was talking.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Sorry about that.